You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello, and welcome back to episode 5 of the City of Man podcast, a show dedicated to trying to understand politics from the vantage of traditional Christian conviction. I'm Coyle Neal, assistant professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Joining me today is Ed Song, associate professor of philosophy in Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California. Ed, how are things out on the left coast?
Like all things leftist, they're perfect, Coyle.
Of course. I was actually at a leftist meeting last night. The Polk County Democrats had their caucus.
Oh, yeah?
Or mass meeting, I guess, is what they call it. You got to have that communist language in there. The mass meeting where they select the delegates to go to the regional meeting, who then vote for Bernie or Hillary, depending on how the popular vote went.
Uh-huh.
It was interesting. Definitely.
You went as a political observer?
I went as the advisor to the Southwest Baptist College Democrats.
Oh, uh-huh.
I will be at the Republican one this weekend as the advisor to the Southwest Baptist College Republicans.
Uh-huh.
Probably more active as a participant there than I was at this one.
But you are the advisor to both of those.
The condition of me being the advisor to one of them was me being the advisor to both of them, yes.
Oh,
I mean, it's the condition I made up, but it was still the only way in which I would do it. I sort of thought that by setting that as a condition, I would just never have to do it. Because at the time, there was no college Democrats.
Uh-huh.
And then all of a sudden, this group forms, and before I know it, I have to be advisor to both because I said I would. So.
Uh-huh. And how do the Democrats feel about having a conservative as their advisor? Isn't that sort of letting the fox into the
You know, it is, but it's also Southwest Missouri. So the Democrats here tend to be more of the blue dog variety, or at least very, very quiet.
You probably like Bernie Sanders a lot more than they do.
You know, that's entirely possible. I think that we should do a Bernie Sanders episode. I think that Bernie Sanders, even just as a Christian, I think you have to acknowledge the personal integrity that that man has. I think it's probably a fair statement to say that he is the most virtuous individual running for president right now, with the understanding that I don't know a lot of the third party guys. I mean, maybe some of them are better. But in terms of having a belief system that he sticks to consistently, honestly and openly, and has his entire career in politics, I don't know that anyone else can make that claim.
I'm glad we're recording that statement. Yeah.
I mean, with the stuff he believes is truly abominable. I'm not saying that his beliefs are correct, but in terms of personal integrity, he's certainly up there.
I don't think I've ever heard anyone impugn his personal integrity. That's not entirely true. Hillary tried that for a spell, but that didn't necessarily.
Right. I mean, I do think that if you don't personally like Bernie Sanders, that there's something wrong with you. Like he's such a likable guy, even with all of the awful things he believes about politics, which is what we're going to be talking about today. If you've been following along with the past few episodes of City of Man, you know that Ed and I are both evangelical Christian academics who study politics and political theory. In the last two episodes, we took a stab at tracing the outlines of conservatism, where I largely plant my political flag. Today, we're going to do the same thing with Ed's side of things. That is, we're going to look at liberalism. Ed, in a sense, I think you've got the harder job here, since as slippery as conservatism can be to define, there aren't actually that many of us. The number of conservatives is relatively small, so having to categorize them is something of a simple job. Liberals, on the other hand, are legion in their numbers and varied in their beliefs, everything from anarchists to modern progressives to libertarians to the totalitarian regimes. So Ed, how do we define liberalism? Is it about more than just the mass execution of infants, legalizing homosexual marriage and worshiping at the altar of Leviathan, or are those just conservative lies about the left? What's really at the heart of what liberals believe?
Yeah, so I'm just trying to follow Jesus, Coyle. That's what I'm trying to do. No, so it's true that the family of liberal thinkers and views is a pretty diverse bunch, like sort of your worst nightmare of Thanksgiving dinner where like all the relatives show up, even the ones that like the family doesn't talk about. It can be a little bit like that. I would actually disagree with you on some of the people who you threw in with the conservative into the liberal family there. Maybe that's something that we can talk about in a bit. But I would say that in general, what all liberalisms have in common, as the name suggests, is a shared commitment that political morality is fundamentally rooted in a certain set of individual rights and liberties, thus liberalism. Right? So what is morally primary here with regard to thinking about the nature of political justice isn't, as it is for the conservative tradition or some set of social values that needs to be preserved, but rather the fact that individuals possess, either because of God or from some other source, an intrinsic kind of dignity that deserves respect. And that dignity constrains the kinds of things that you could do to people, even if doing them in some ways could produce good consequences or outcomes that we might care about. So these rights and liberties describe a kind of protected space around individuals that needs to be respected by others and the government. So that's what I would say, like, all liberalisms have in common. And then where they're going to differ, obviously, is in the set of liberal values that they're committed to, or their interpretation of those values. And then obviously, different kinds of thinkers who might be in the liberal family are going to have strong disagreements about those things. You know, so you mentioned anarchism, and anarchism is, I would say that anarchism fits in as a kind of a liberal view. Anarchism is rooted in a really robust picture of human liberty or autonomy.
Really robust.
Yeah. So yeah, capital R, really robust. I mean, the idea is that people have an intrinsic kind of liberty that can never be infringed, even by government, right? And so because government fundamentally involves coercion of its citizens in some ways, no government is legitimate because no exercise of coercive power against another human being is morally justifiable precisely because it conflicts with this liberty or autonomy. So you can think of anarchism as a liberal view rooted in this really strong particular kind of picture of human liberty or autonomy. Then, you know, you also mentioned Marxism and totalitarianism. I would say that I would exclude both of those views as being in the liberal family, though I recognize in some ways that that's a little bit of a controversial thing. I actually think in the case of Marxism, I mean, really talking about Marx in particular, the case for excluding Marx is a little bit more obvious, just because Marx himself is like a vociferous. I mean, there are a lot of different things about Marx. I mean, Marx, in some ways, like, you know, he denies that he's doing anything like political theory or theorizing. The Marxist view is meant to be like an empirical analysis of
science, right?
Yeah, exactly. And then Marx is a critic of liberal political thought precisely because he thinks it's false ideology and the rights and liberties that they care about are merely formal. Now, it's obviously the case that in Marxism, a lot of the core ideas are going to be things that progressives, let's say liberal progressives, are going to care about, right? So, you know, certainly not every kind of liberal, not classical liberals or libertarians, but progressive liberals, social liberals, are going to care about exploitation and alienation and class warfare. They're going to care about those things. But sort of technically speaking, and certainly like the development of socialist political thought is influential in amongst progressive liberals and liberal progressive social reformers. But sort of technically speaking, I would say Marx is a different kettle of fish.
So would it be fair to say that if we're taking your definition of liberalism, and the word that conservatives will often apply to speaking about the liberal categories is they believe in the autonomy of the individual. Mm-hmm. That is, you build a worldview around the idea that the basis of everything is the individual human being, as opposed to the conservative view that's going to want to talk about the individual as a social animal that does not exist by himself. But in terms of whether or not Marx fits into that liberal category, is sort of the answer to the question, do Marx and the other totalitarians count as liberals, is that contingent on whether or not their thought can be traced back to the idea that the individual is central. So like if we can show that Marx's concern is primarily to begin with the individual and build from there, he counts as a liberal. And if we can't show that, he doesn't. Would that be a fair way to analyze that?
Yeah. So a lot of it depends on how you choose to cut the cake up. I mean, so you can choose to cut the cake such that everyone from classical liberals or libertarians to progressive liberals to anarchists to Marxists and totalitarians, I mean, you can cut the cake so that they're all in the same piece, I guess.
Right.
I mean, you know, there's a way in which if you really wanted to, you could cut the cake in ways that sort of also include conservatives.
Sure.
So obviously not every way of dividing people up to me is sort of going to be equally helpful. Well, I would actually
assuming a fair reading of Marx, assuming that we're sort of trying to read him the way that he intended. And obviously neither of us are Marx scholars. Mm-hmm. Neither of us are specialists in the totalitarian movements of the 20th century. But I guess the question is, if they are doing that, even if you disagree with the outcome, the way I as a conservative might say, I don't like the movements in conservatism that existed to defend slavery or to defend segregation, but I don't really get to say that those aren't conservative. Mm-hmm. Like, does that sort of logic apply here, or are they just so different? Like, is there something?
Yeah. So a couple of things there. So two things. The first thing that I said, that when you redefine liberalism back to me, you sort of put this big emphasis on the individual and the individual existing apart from society. And that's not the way that I put the point. And I avoided putting it that way for very specific reasons. I mean, it's certainly true that liberal political thought is rooted in a kind of normative individualism. Again, it's rooted in the idea. So I stuck to the language of rights and liberties.
Right.
But it's rooted in the idea that individuals possess certain rights and liberties that are inviolable.
Regardless of society.
Yes. So it might well be the case that you could violate those rights and it would produce certain social goods. But the liberal will always say, but you can't do that. Right. So rights, to use the language of the political philosopher Dworkin, they sort of operate as trumps, like they trump claims. And so it's certainly the case that liberalism is rooted in a kind of a normative individualism in that way. But I sort of chafe against describing it as in the way that you did, as sort of drawing a distinction between individual and society. It's not like the liberal thinks that society is a bad thing. They see society as being important. They see human connectedness as being important, though it is the case that sometimes, at least, individuals have a kind of, well, again, these rights and liberties that they possess deserve a kind of respect, which is going to constrain certain ways that you can treat them. And that might well be the case that there are certain social goods that liberals, that is forbidden by liberalism. But I sort of chafe a little bit. The main point here is that I chafe a little bit against that talk of individualism, because it sort of makes liberals seem like that they're committed to this crazy view that like society isn't important, that human flourishing doesn't occur within societies, that huge parts of our identity and what matters in life are formed by the social bonds and connections that we don't have.
If I'm understanding this correctly, and please correct me if I'm not, you're saying that liberalism is not just the different bodies of thought that begin with the individual. It's also that you must begin with the individual and then build that thought in a specific direction. Right, there is a right way to start at the individual and build up, and a liberal way to do it, and a non-liberal way to do it. The totalitarians, if they begin with the individual and build up, they're doing it in the wrong way. These other categories that we'll get to in a few minutes, they're doing it the right way. So they're the liberals, and these other guys aren't. Is that fair?
Well, yeah. So I mean, again, I would say like the first way of putting it, the point, the main thing that I was chafing against is sort of pitting in liberals as being like against or failing to recognize the importance of our social ties. But then the second thing that I was going to say that gets a little bit to your point, let's go with your definition, actually, the one that I was trying to avoid. You know, liberalism committed to a kind of an individualism. And then I would say that, like, Marxism clearly isn't committed to that kind of individualism. I mean, one of the main... Marx is concerned with human flourishing. And, I mean, we exist as individuals. Like, that's a fact. But Marx's big criticism in a lot of ways is that capitalist production engenders a kind of an alienation that separates us from other people, right? So Marx recognizes in really, really important ways that, like, our social bonds are critically important from us. And one of the really bad things about capitalist production is that it engenders, I mean, it creates this competition between people that alienates us. It alienates us from our fellow workers. He thinks we're fundamentally homo faber, right? Productive man.
Right.
And capitalist production creates all these alienations that screw that up. One of them being it alienates us from other people.
But again, he begins with that individual alienation and moves in a direction that ends somewhere very different. So if I'm summarizing you right, what you're saying is that by moving in that direction, he is leaving liberalism, or he was just never there to begin with. He has sort of set himself aside from what it is that makes liberalism liberalism. Is that fair?
Yeah. So
it's also where you end and how you get there.
Yeah. So I guess what I would say is that Marxists are actually starting off in a slightly different point and ending in a slightly different point, though there are obviously ideals that Marxist political thinkers are committed to that progressive liberals, at least, are going to be sympathetic with. Again, alienation, exploitation, condition of workers. Liberals, this is a little bit of a tricky thing, but liberals care about equality. And that's obviously a value for Marxist thinkers. What equality means is going to be is something that we can talk about later. But so I think there's a lot of sympathy, but sort of strictly speaking, I would square off the Marxists from the liberals. And then you wanted to talk about totalitarianism too?
Yeah, I don't know that we need to draw too much of a distinction between Marxism and totalitarianism. Sort of international totalitarianism versus national totalitarianism. Mm-hmm. The question was more, since I had mentioned them as liberalism and as a subset of liberals, and you push back on that, well why? What of your definition makes you want to push back against that?
Yeah, again,
off the reservation.
So I can't remember exactly what I said, but I think when I was formulating that first definition of liberalism, I think I tried to formulate it in terms of rights and liberties, and I didn't use the language of autonomy
right
until we started talking about the anarchists. And I also did that on purpose just because autonomy is a little bit of a loaded concept. I mean, you know, autonomy literally means to give oneself a law, right? And we sort of think of that as being synonymous with just about being free. But political philosophers sometimes make a distinction between negative liberties and positive liberties.
Right.
Negative liberties are liberties from external interference. So, and you know, these are a lot of the classic liberal civil political liberties that we find enshrined in bills of rights, you know, things that we're familiar with, right? So freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of religion and conscience, those are all negative liberties insofar as what they mean is nobody's to interfere with you. And then in contrast, there are positive liberties, which are liberties like not just freedom from interference, but positive provision of certain kinds of things. So if you thought we had a right to healthcare, for example, what that means isn't just that nobody is to interfere with you as you try to go out and get healthcare. What that means is that, no, that should be provided to you.
Right. There are legal obligations that go along with that on society.
Legal,
or there should be.
Yeah. Legal or moral. Yeah. And then similarly, you could say something similar with like autonomy. And I think typically the way that we think about autonomy is, again, freedom from external interference. I'm autonomous if nobody has bound my wrists or thrown me in jail or, those are extreme examples. Or you could sort of think of autonomy in a positive way, that like what it is to be genuinely free is to, be a particular kind of a person. And it's that notion of autonomy that I think you could say totalitarians are committed to, right? So, you know, if you want to talk about totalitarians pursuing individual autonomy in that sense, you know, what they mean isn't that, oh, we really want people to be free from external interference so that they can worship whatever gods they want to worship or raise their kids however they want to raise them. You know, what they mean is we're molding them to be a particular kind of a person. And so only being that kind of person are people genuinely free.
Right. We have an ideal that we are going to move towards that every individual should live up to.
Yes. And in order to accomplish that, we need to use the state to mold, to, you know, to get rid of those bad people, first of all, who corrupt or, you know, who corrupt society and poison people and make it impossible to, like, achieve, you know, genuine Aryan autonomy or whatever.
Or right? Genuine autonomy of the proletariat or genuine autonomy.
Enemies that get in the way of genuine autonomy and flourishing.
Right. So the obstructions to me, you know, fulfilling myself from that worldview are those other people out there, because I would never obstruct myself. I'm a good person. It's this conspiracy. It's these evil, you know, monsters out there that have to be stopped. Be they the rich, be they the Jews, be they whoever the enemies of your particular totalitarian state happen to
be. Yeah, exactly. And then, so I would say, so you could say of either Marxists or totalitarians that they're liberals because they're committed to this, because they're committed to autonomy. But then I would say, yeah, you could put the point that way, but the kind of autonomy that they care about is importantly distinct from the kind of autonomy, or again, I think a better way of putting the point is the kinds of rights and liberties that unify what I would say are genuine liberal thinkers, right? Because Marxists and totalitarians don't care about political liberties or freedom of speech or freedom of exercise of religion and conscience and assembly and all of this.
So you're saying it's not just that there is a goal and a means and a beginning point, but there are also specific rights and liberties that you must believe in to be a liberal.
Yeah, and those rights and liberties that we find enshrined in the constitutions and bills of rights of modern liberal democratic states. So the kinds of things that we find in the American Bill of Rights, I think of those things as being foundational for liberals. And again, liberals, so on this view, classical liberals, libertarians are liberals, and social liberals, political progressives are also liberals. And they obviously, they differ a lot as to the priority or ordering of those liberal rights or the way that they interpret them. One simple thing that we could say is that I would say social progressives of the kind that I'm sympathetic with, they see a right to equality in a particular kind of way. Classical liberals also care about equality, but they're committed to a far weaker notion of equality. That's one thing. One big difference. And then I would also say classical liberals see property, have a very robust understanding of property rights, under which taxation is basically morally akin to theft. And then I would say progressive liberals, they believe in property rights, but it's a far different understanding of what property rights are and how they work. So Coyle, we've been talking a lot about the content of liberalism, and that's something that we're going to need to continue to talk about. But maybe it would also be helpful if we took a step back and looked a little bit at the historical genesis of the rise of liberal political thought. Do you want to, you're a much stronger historian of ideas than I am. Do you want to get us going?
So as should be clear from our conversation, liberalism is very big and sort of slippery and hard to define. Even figuring out where it starts can be a challenge. Historical philosophers can fight about this sort of thing all day. You could look at something like the Iliad and see a proto-liberalism there, where you have Achilles asserting his individual rights against the king. You can look at someone like Martin Luther, who says, you know, my conscience is the thing that I am subject to, not any law of pope or emperor. But really, sort of formal philosophical liberalism I would kick off with Descartes and Hobbes. And because I know so much less about Descartes, I'll focus on Hobbes, who starts with the individual and sort of builds his philosophical system around that, using reason as a tool. So Hobbes begins with from the perspective of what he can know. So in sort of a Cartesian sense, works out an entire philosophy of everything. Of course, the only thing anyone reads these days is the Leviathan, and not even much of that. But he does have books basically on every major subject. Hobbes then kicks off this tradition of contract theory that eventually leads into classical liberalism. So John Locke, of course, responds to and interacts with Hobbes, develops his thought in some interesting and unique ways, leads eventually to writers like Adam Smith, de Tocqueville on the continent, Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin in the American context, which you're going to talk more about that. So I won't say much about classical liberalism here. Also on the continent, you have the Romantics. So people like Rousseau, who is very, very difficult to categorize, but is also sort of the anti-conservative. He is the big bugbear that the conservatives like to hold up as typical of all liberal thought. Whether that is fair or not, he's the one that they tend to use. The German idealists, of course, are very very much a part of this movement, Kant and Hegel. Later, you get Nietzsche and Kierkegaard, and again, we could argue about whether or not Marx and his ilk fit in here, but they are at least in the stream loosely related to liberalism. Whether they're fully liberal or not, I suppose that's a longer conversation. In America, you have the pragmatists, sort of people who would say we're not really ideologues, we're not really philosophically anything, we're just doing what works. But of course, what works in their worldview is kind of social progressivism, a crypto-social progressivism. So I think we can probably go ahead and classify them as liberals, even if it's against their wishes. So people like Dewey and James, very influential on American on the American education system, ultimately influential on politics when you see the rise of President Woodrow Wilson, kind of the last of the great presidents who was also philosophically informed to some extent anyway. Which then becomes sort of the springboard to the 20th century. And I'm going to turn that over to you, Ed, because I know so little about 20th century philosophical liberalism. In my mind, it's sort of a jumble of Rawls and Heidegger and Foucault and Derrida and Russian writers whose names I wouldn't even begin to pronounce. And I just sort of lump them all together because I know nothing about the 20th century. So what is 20th century liberalism? Who do we need to be focusing on here? What are some of the big ideas and developments?
Typical conservative, you're just stuck in the 19th century and you haven't realized that we're in the 21st century anymore.
And I'm so much happier for it.
I would say that in many ways, I'm very typical of my guild. So like I am an Anglo-American political philosopher. I'm not very fluent at all in like the history of political thought outside of a few central thinkers. And a lot of those thinkers who you mentioned, like Heidegger, are thinkers that are outside of the particular tradition that I operate in.
And potentially not even liberals at all, right?
Yeah. But just to sort of go back through your little historical overview there, liberalism, this family of political views that are rooted in the priority of a certain set of rights and liberties, sort of typically that story begins with Hobbes. Hobbes is a funny kind of figure because he wasn't defending anything like the familiar rights and liberties that liberals care about these days. But, you know, central to his thought is this idea that the authority of the political sovereign comes from the consent of the governed. It comes from contract. And that's an important idea. And then you get to a figure like Locke, another social contract theorist. I mean, for both Hobbes and Locke, it's not like they thought there was ever a moment in time at which people got together and all actually consented. But right. Still, that idea of political justification is springing from contract or consent lies at their heart. And so that's a very liberal idea. And then also in Rawls, also in Locke, a little Freudian slip there, huh?
Right.
Also in Locke, we start to see the defense of ideas that are recognizably liberal, right? So Locke famously defends our right to life, liberty, and property.
Right. And both of them are responding to what would eventually become conservative claims about the state, right? So they're both sort of firing back against that traditional worldview of communitarianism and the state as divine.
The divine right of kings.
Yeah. So they are, even if they have different shades of what they're doing, they're both responding to the same
thing. Yeah. And Locke himself is very active in the Republican movement in England. His two treatises on government are trying to provide like the intellectual justification for revolting against the monarchy.
Yeah, it's one of those things where we can really wish Hobbes had lived a couple of years longer, even though he lived to extreme. He was like, 90 something when he died? I mean, he was really old for the time. Died a couple of years before the Glorious Revolution. And I would just love to know what he had thought, because he was all over the place in his political support. And I mean, it would really put a nice capstone on his Leviathan if we knew what he thought about deposing a sovereign who is only sort of legitimate with another sovereign who is also sort of legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That same idea of contract, and can you shift the contract around?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, tangent on Hobbes. Sorry, I'm teaching on him this semester.
He's
on the brain.
So, I mean, you get those social contract theorists, Kant as well. And you get to someone like John Stuart Mill in the 19th century. Mill is a really interesting figure because on the one hand, he's very classically liberal at certain parts of his intellectual career and very much defends a laissez-faire kind of an economy. His book On Liberty is like a central tract in the intellectual development of liberal democracy and liberal rights as we know it now. And then interestingly, towards the end of his, I mean, this is maybe why Mill in particular is an important transitional figure, because in Mill, towards the end of his career, you start to see this concern with social welfare and seeing liberal ideals being directed towards caring about the social conditions of the impoverished. And one of the things, I mean, the big thing that's going on here, obviously, is industrialization is going on. And a lot of thinkers like Mill or social reformers are reacting over and against the carnage of industrialization in a lot of ways, the conditions that workers were forced to live under, child labor, things like that.
But reacting in very specific ways, right? So you have the, sorry to interrupt you on this, but you have the conservative reaction we talked about last time that looks at this and says, these conditions are terrible. We need to get rid of them and go back to medievalism. You know, go back to the more feudal society where children are not sent down into the mines or into factories. They live on a farm.
Mm-hmm.
So how is that different from Mill's reaction? Both of which are responding with sort of horror to this. And again, Marx is doing the same thing, right? They're looking at these conditions and saying that these are awful. Which sort of raises the question, if the conservatives, the liberals, and the communists are all against it, who on earth is in favor of it? You know, who's even left?
Factory owners.
I guess so. But how is the liberal response different from these other responses that we've already talked about?
Yeah, so it got directed towards wanting to enact certain kinds of laws that would institute protections for workers and for children's, a concern for inequality, for social welfare programs. You see it in the United States in the Roosevelt administration, in both Roosevelt administrations in some ways, in terms of antitrust and breaking up these huge mammoth monopolistic corporations in responding to the Great Depression, trying to institute social welfare programs to protect people from the ravages of the Depression and poverty and unemployment. So it manifests itself in seeing government as being the only agent that can address these widespread social problems that come from like the massive social changes brought about by modernization and industrialization. So, I mean, to me, one of the interesting things about the rise of call it social liberalism out of classical libertarian liberalism is, I mean, you have thinkers like Mill, who is changing his mind, becomes a lot more concerned about social welfare, sees the state as playing an important role in trying to achieve some of those ends, even arguing for redistribution at some points. And then I think the thing that's also, there are important intellectual figures at the same time, like, you know, Hobhouse and Hobson in England, T.H. Green as well. But a lot of it is driven on by, you know, not pointy-headed academic intellectual types, but, you know, real social reformers who care a lot about addressing these social problems.
And then I would want to jump all the way up to 1971 and the publication of A Theory of Justice by the Harvard philosopher John Rawls. We're skipping a lot of stuff here, obviously, but as I think we both agreed last time, Rawls's book is the most influential work of political philosophy in the 20th century. Rawls argues for a very progressive standard of distributive justice that justifies robust social welfare programs to ensure that the benefits and burdens of social cooperation are distributed in a fair way. And one of the reasons why the book is so interesting to political philosophers is that Rawls comes up with a very ingenious, clever kind of an argument in defense of this progressive account of social justice. That argument, though, is also highly technical and invites confusions. Rawls is a philosopher's philosopher. He certainly isn't writing for a general audience, and his argument can be really dense and abstract and technical.
Right. So you're saying everyone should go out and read A Theory of Justice?
Yeah, not so much. I don't know that that would be the best use of anyone's time unless you're really deep into this stuff. But I do think that the argument is compelling, and it is formative for the way that I think about things. So with that said, let me take a minute to try to unpack Rawls's argument. Actually, let me start at the end with his conclusion. So his conclusion is actually pretty simple. Rawls thinks that there are exactly two principles of justice. The first he calls the principle of greatest equal liberty, and it says that people should have as extensive a set of basic liberties as is compatible for all. So, in other words, people should be as free as they can possibly be. Rawls is basically arguing here for the centrality of those rights and liberties that are familiar to us in documents like the Bill of Rights. He thinks that justice demands a right of free speech, of assembly, religious freedom, and liberties of conscience, all of those things. This claim isn't particularly controversial, so let's skip to the second principle of justice, which is considerably more controversial. It is called the difference principle, and it argues that social goods like wealth should be distributed in such a way as to maximize the shares of the most disadvantaged class of people within a society. So, in other words, of all of the different arrangements that are possible, of all of the different rates of taxation and social programs that a government could possibly institute, justice demands that we choose the one in which the most disadvantaged class does as well as they possibly can. There's a lot of debate here about what this arrangement is actually going to look like in its details. Let's skip over this for now and just stick to the big point. And suffice it to say that justice for Rawls is going to look a lot more like the kind of social democracy that we find in Scandinavian countries like Denmark or Finland than it is the United States. There is going to be inequality under the difference principle. Some people are going to do better than others, maybe even considerably better than others. But it is going to be a situation with higher rates of taxation and correspondingly more robust social welfare programs than we currently find in the United States. So those are the two principles of justice. And now I should say something about the argument that Rawls gives in support of them. So like Hobbes and Locke, who we just talked about, Rawls offers up a social contract theory. And again, the basic idea here is that for all these theories, we're going to try to argue for a set of principles of justice by thinking about what kinds of principles of justice would be chosen by people who are living in some kind of pre-political situation, right? So what kind of political institutions would be chosen if we were creating them from scratch. Rawls, though, takes this basic idea of the social contract to a higher level of abstraction. The whole point for Rawls is that the idea of a social contract or agreement in his theory acts as a heuristic device or a conceptual model that structures an intuition that we all share about the nature of justice and shows that this conviction actually isn't general or vague, but actually recommends a very specific account of justice, the two principles of justice that I just mentioned. So Rawls thinks that there is a single, widely shared, and deeply held intuition about justice that is shared by conservative and liberal alike, and that if we can get clear about it, it should actually commit us to a pretty progressive vision for politics. And so this core intuition is just the idea that there is an intrinsic value or dignity or equality that we all have, whose source is totally independent from a whole variety of contingent facts about us. So, for example, I'm a man, I'm 40-something, I'm Korean-American, I live in California, I'm married, I'm a Christian, etc. These are all facts about myself that are really important to me and make up who I am and how I think about myself. So they're all really important in one way. But Rawls also thinks that they are all, and here's an important phrase for all of these facts about myself are arbitrary from the moral point of view. And what this means is that justice shouldn't treat people differently on the basis of these contingent facts. The state can't treat men one way and women another, or blacks one way and whites another. This is just the basic idea that we find symbolized in all of those statues of blindfolded Lady Justice on the steps of courthouses. Justice is supposed to be blind to all of these contingent differences. They matter immensely in one way, that's really important, but they don't matter in another. We are all equal. So that is supposed to be a pretty uncontroversial claim, but Rawls thinks that if you're committed to this idea of equality, then you ought to also be committed to his progressive vision of justice. And his argument goes like this. It's a social contract theory, so you imagine everybody in the country getting together to decide what rules will guide their life together. Rawls actually calls this contract position. He calls it the original position. And you might imagine that under these conditions, everyone is going to want to choose principles of justice that most benefit themselves. So if I'm rich, I want low rates of taxation and correspondingly minimal social welfare programs. And if I'm poor, I want the exact opposite. But then what happens, Rawls represents that core intuition that justice shouldn't treat people differently on the basis of facts about them that are arbitrary from the moral point of view. He represents that idea in the theory by something that he calls the veil of ignorance. So right before all of these people sit down to deliberate, the veil drops, and it strips from view from each contractor all of those facts about them that are arbitrary from the moral point of view. So a person no longer knows if they're a man or a woman, black or white, a Fortune 500 CEO, or a teenager growing up in Appalachia. And then the question is, what principles of justice would be chosen from behind the veil of ignorance if you didn't know these facts about yourself? And then Rawls argues that under these conditions of uncertainty, people would choose to make sure that the worst case scenario for them would be as good as it could possibly be. So they would choose the principle of greatest equal liberty, so that they could ensure that whoever they were in real life, whatever they believed in, whether they were Christians or Jews or Zoroastrians, they would be free to pursue their own conception of the good without interference. And then Rawls argues that they would also choose the difference principle because they would want to make sure that if they end up as the most disadvantaged class, in the most disadvantaged class, they would have as many resources as possible to live a decent life. They wouldn't choose a state with no social welfare programs or very limited social welfare programs because they would be afraid that they would end up in that most disadvantaged class. So that's a mouthful, and there's a whole lot that more that could be said, but that's Rawls's argument in a nutshell. And again, what's kind of clever about it is that it's rooted in this premise that is supposed to be widely shared and deeply held. But that intuition also recommends this pretty far-reaching progressive conclusion about politics. And the whole theory works by trying to show that this commitment that we have to moral equality isn't just like a vague general moral truth, but once we see it aright, it should actually force us into a pretty progressive view about justice.
Yeah, so even as a traditionalist conservative, I can admit that the great strength of Rawls is that if you buy his premises, it is very, very difficult to say he's wrong. Right. Now the problem is I have not read Theory of Justice. I've only read his attempt to shorten and simplify it in Justice is Fairness. But if what he's basically doing is separating sort of physical reality and morality and justice from each other and saying, all right, since we've done that, I'm right. And that's where my pushback is going to be. Well, wait a second. I didn't agree to that. Like I don't think that's okay at all. I don't think those things are necessarily separate from each other. I think you have to accept those three all together because that's sort of what the real world is like.
Yeah, I think that's true in a way, Coyle. It is true that the argument is structured in such a way that if you accept the premises, then you have to accept the conclusion. But I would say that that's not a bug, that's a feature of the argument. The idea is to sew a purse from a philosophical sow's ear, I guess, to try to start with these premises that are meant to be very uncontroversial, very intuitive, hard to deny, and to actually show you that they lead to pretty far-reaching, surprising conclusions.
Right, and the two assumptions there are that moral reasoning can be done in a vacuum, which I would certainly say that's not possible. Like, I cannot abstract myself from myself to reason morally. But and it is assuming that the moral framework that he is bringing to bear in this vacuum is the one that we all agree on.
Yeah, so again, I would say that the methodological aspects of the theory are highly technical and controversial. But I would still say that that's not quite right. Moral reasoning isn't happening here in a vacuum. Again, Rawls's idea is that he's trying to start with an intuition that is widely shared, at least within liberal societies like our own, that differences that are arbitrary from the moral point of view shouldn't count with the way that the state treats us. Justice should be blind to those things. And that, I think, is a very widely shared intuition by real people in the real world. And then he's trying to show you that if you really believe that, then that actually recommends an ideal of equality that can only be satisfied by the two principles of justice. So certainly the theory is abstract and technical in certain kinds of ways, but I don't think it's accurate to say that moral reasoning occurs in a vacuum. The whole point of the theory is that it's starting with an intuition that is widely shared by people who live in liberal democracies, whether they are liberals or conservatives.
Is it fair to say that Rawls cannot conceive someone saying in a vacuum, in this abstraction that he's created, he cannot imagine someone saying that regardless of whatever circumstances I find myself in, it is right that I obey the king? I mean, is that fair? Like he is bringing his pre-existing moral framework to the argument. So if you come at this from someone who lives, you know, we talked about the people defending the divine right of kings. If you bring that into the vacuum, if that's the framework that you bring with you, which of course then you're not abstracting yourself, you're bringing your framework in. So cheating from the outset at sort of best, which, you know, who of us doesn't?
Yeah. It is true in a way that Rawls is importing his own moral framework into the theory, but that's a pejorative way to put the point. He's not importing, again, the idea is that intuition, that differences that are arbitrary from the moral point of view shouldn't count, that's not just an intuition that Rawls shares, that's an intuition that everybody shares. Well, your royalist won't share that intuition, that's true. But, I mean, a theory can't address everybody all at the same time. Rawls is writing a particular kind of book and constructing a particular kind of an argument to address people in Western democratic
countries that share certain kinds of intuitions. Now, that's not to say that the theory is subjectivist in some kind of a way, but it is just trying to say that there's a particular argumentative context that Rawls is trying to address. He's trying to address Americans living in the 1970s that share certain kinds of assumptions. And, you know, every argument has to start with certain kinds of assumptions. You can't start from nowhere. And so in a way, somebody could question your assumptions. But then Rawls's point is, yeah, you could question my assumptions, and then I could have a very different kind of conversation with you, royalist, who dispute this idea that differences that are arbitrary from the moral point of view shouldn't count. And then if you and I were having a conversation, I'd have to give you a very different kind of an argument. But in this book, anyways, I'm just not interested in addressing people like you. I want to start further up the chain and address a very different kind of an argument. And so I'm going to start with a premise that we all share and that is uncontroversial amongst us. So that premise is going to be controversial to the royalists, but again, Rawls isn't interested in addressing the royalist in this book. Right. That would be another kind of a book.
Right. So really, when you say he's a philosopher's philosopher, you mean he is a liberal's philosopher. Like, people who buy his premises with him, they're going to buy into, but people who say, well, wait a second, that's not morality. That's not the framework that I'm working from.
Yeah, so he's a liberal's philosopher, I guess you could say, but liberal in the widest sense. So again, people defending the divine right of kings aren't going to be very persuaded by the argument, but so that's fine. That would require a different kind of a book. But, I mean, he's a liberal's philosopher insofar as, in order to go along the argument with him, you have to accept this liberal premise that differences that are arbitrary from the moral point of view shouldn't count. Just the state shouldn't treat people differently on the basis of these various different facts about us. Again, our ethnicity, our age, our geographical location. These are all facts that are really, really important in one way. But with regard, from the perspective of justice, they're not important at all. The state shouldn't treat people differently on the basis of these basic facts. And that is a kind of a liberal premise, if you like, but that is a liberal premise that is shared by any modern American conservative or traditionalist conservative. That is not a controversial conclusion amongst people who live in the 20th or 21st century in Western liberal countries.
Right. Well, more focused, we might say something like maybe my starting moral framework is you shall not kill. I suspect that at the end of the day, Rawls and I are still going to both disagree on something like abortion. Right.
Yeah. There's a very famous footnote in one of Rawls's book in which he sort of settles the problem of abortion in a footnote. Yeah, that's right. And for what it's worth, Rawls actually recognizes that there can be alternative interpretations of the two principles of justice. And there are certain changes that go on in Rawls's theory as he evolves through the 70s and 80s and sort of reworks the theory in important ways in the 90s. But that's definitely not what we're talking about. I would say this. Rawls builds in room in the theory for disagreement. But again, I would say this about the starting point. He doesn't put it this way, but I'll put it this way. People have an intrinsic kind of dignity and value that is separate from certain social facts about them. So your dignity, or no one's dignity, comes from the fact, fundamental dignity, comes from the fact that they are a man or a woman, or black or white, or rich or poor, or highly educated or ill-educated, or... somebody with an IQ of 160 or somebody who is mentally challenged in some way, right?
Right.
It's starting from that intuition. And look, there are people who will disagree with that intuition. But, and then Rawls could say, well, look, I can't please everybody. If I wanted to talk to you, I would need to have a different kind of theory. But virtually everybody else abides by those premises. And I would say that even you, Coyle, abide by those premises.
Largely because I live in a world that has been dominated by thought like that of John Rawls for so long. I mean, I don't know that I could deny that. but it's not because I want to.
Well, no. I think you're being cagey. I think it's a case that you accept those premises, and you actually happily accept those premises. And again, the idea is simply this. The value that you have as a person, or at least the value that you have with regard to the state, the way in which the state treats people, that value isn't dependent upon being a particular gender or a particular ethnicity or a particular age or from a particular geographical region or having a particular IQ or being of a particular region. You think that it would be unjust for the state to treat people differently on the basis of any of those facts. And you don't think that begrudgingly, you think that deep in your bones, for whatever reasons that you might have, you really believe those things, and you don't believe them begrudgingly, and we all believe those things, and we all believe them for our various different reasons. But again, the theory is rooted, people try to make a lot of hay out of this, but it's really rooted in a moral ideal that is widely shared and deeply held. This basic idea of equality under law, this basic idea that people have a dignity whose roots doesn't lie in these various particularities about ourselves. Not to say that these particularities don't have value in other contexts or in other ways, but the dignity that we have under law isn't rooted in any of them.
So, for example, your son has a particular kind of dignity and value that needs to be respected by the state that is independent of all of these various particularities about him, however valuable those might be in their own rights in other contexts.
Yeah, so I would say that it's both. So my son does have an intrinsic value, certainly as a Christian, you know, he's made in the image of God, but I would also say he has value because of the specific factual aspects that are true about him. So there are things about him that give him value that are inseparable from him. So it does matter that he is not quite 2 years old. It does matter that those are things that if you remove those, you remove who he is as a person. Like these are facts about him that go into the moral framework. And I think to say, well, that's not part of justice is missing something that's essential.
Yes,
to justice.
Yes, that's all exactly right. And Rawls isn't denying any of that. I mean, those various particularities, the fact that he is your son, the fact that he has your wife's chin, let's say, the fact that, you want to raise him within this particular kind of a tradition, the fact that he has, your mother's eyes, all of these facts about him are really, really important. They're important to you. And as he grows in this particular part of the country, in this particular tradition, with these particular interests that he may have, those are going to be really important aspects of his identity, things that have great intrinsic value to him. And Rawls is not denying any of that. Again, the idea is that while all of those things matter and have value, those things aren't the source of the value that he has for the state. From the state's perspective, the value that he has, the equal treatment that the state needs to show him, isn't rooted in any of those things, such that if you change any of them, the state would no longer recognize his equality and dignity, right? His equality and dignity lies in something else that is completely independent of those things. And again, that is the idea that Rawls is trying to model in the original position.
So I guess where I'd push back a little bit about that view of justice is that, again, you're creating an abstraction that not only doesn't actually exist, but actually kills something of justice in the real world. So to look at my son and say that, yeah, there are all of those particularities that go into you, but really what matters is that you fit this category of my son, and if I unplugged you from it and stuck someone else in there, it would be exactly the same thing. I'm not really being terribly just to my actual real world son any more than if I were to say something like that to my wife. I love you because you fill this abstract category. No, it's you are this real person who has all of these particularities, and those things are inseparable, right? My son is in the category of my son, but he is also all of that other stuff, and you can't tear those apart. And I think Rawls is, in a sense, doing that in order to justify where he wants to go politically. He wants to end up at a place, and the way to do that is to jump around the particularities of the real world, and in a sense, really to jump around sort of traditional morality. I And I don't know that he would necessarily even disagree with that jumping around traditional morality part. I think that he was pretty open about what he was doing when it came to that sort of thing.
What do you mean by that?
Well, again, the idea of separating what people would traditionally say has to do with morality as being tied to people and places and events and so on, and saying, no, we have to judge apart from all of that. And again, I'm not going so much from Theory of Justice as I am from the first few pages of Justice's Fairness here. So maybe that's a revision in his argument that isn't in the original, and I'm
So again, so two things here. First, that latter point that you're making about Rawls's later work, the theory evolves in certain kinds of ways in which Rawls is trying to wrestle with the problem of pluralism in modern liberal democracies. With regard to the more core point that you're making, again, that's a very, very familiar criticism that people make all the time. But again, I think that's not right. Again, Rawls isn't denying that these particularities matter. They matter immensely. He's not suggesting that you could just swap out your son from some other kid and, you know, you would love him equally or that would matter. He's not saying that at all. That would be a crazy view. Again, the idea is that Rawls makes this point in the beginning of Theory of Justice that, like, this is a theory of justice. He's not approaching, like, justice as the largest category in which you could possibly approach it. It's not like the Republic in that way. Rawls says, you know, you could work out a wider kind of a theory of justice. And maybe in some ways you could take the method that I'm approaching to come up with that wider theory of justice. But that's not what I'm doing in this book. I am addressing the subject of justice in this very particular context of looking at social and political institutions like ours. And that is all that he's talking about. It is not a theory of justice for families. It is not a theory of justice about how you should treat your son versus how you should treat others. We might say that because your son is your son, you are justified in showing him partiality in a particular kind of a way. But in other kinds of circumstances, that kind of partiality would be objectionable. So for example, you know, if your son was one of your students, then you couldn't treat him with the same kind of partiality. That would be to violate the principles of justice that exist within educational institutions. And then we move to political institutions. And again, there is a certain kind of justice that is demanded at the level of political institutions. And again, Rawls's point there is just that the dignity and equality that people deserves to be recognized by the state is not dependent upon all of these various social facts about ourselves. The state of Missouri or the federal government of the United States shouldn't treat your son in a particular kind of way because he's your son. The fact that he's your son is important in a whole variety of different ways, but it's not important from the perspective of political justice.
So any of the stuff about them as humans doesn't matter. Again, my response, or I think the generally traditionalist response, is going to be that you are functionally just saying humans don't matter.
No, I wouldn't say that. People matter. People matter immensely. And again, Rawls isn't saying that these various different facts about ourselves, that you are a man, that you are a Christian, that you are a professor, that all of these facts, like, those facts matter. Humans matter. But the point is that from the perspective of justice, the reason why this state should show no partiality towards you, that's not rooted in any of those things. And the simplest way to put the point is, Coyle, if you weren't a man but a woman, should the state treat you differently? Do you cease to have dignity before the state? Or if you were a secular humanist instead of a Christian, do you fail to have dignity before the state? And the answer to all of those questions is no. So again, not denying that these facts about us matter, and anything but saying that humans don't matter. It's saying humans matter a great deal. Human beings have an intrinsic kind of dignity that deserves respect. And that dignity, the source of that dignity, isn't any of these particularities about us. It is rooted in something deeper. And the way to represent that idea, again, in the theory, is through the veil of ignorance. It represents that idea that justice shouldn't treat people differently on the basis of these facts about us that are arbitrary from the moral point of view. Or maybe I should say arbitrary from the moral point of view for political justice.
Yeah, and I guess my hesitation in and this is, I guess, quickly becoming a Rawls episode, which is fine because it's liberalism, right? My hesitation is Rawls, to take something like the category of the poor, what Rawls seems to want to do is to help out poor people in general. So let's move towards a theory of justice by which the lowest classes of society are helped. My concern is that in defining away those classes, he loses his own grounds to help them. Whereas if I say, no, those classes actually matter, it's much easier for me to say it is because you, the individual, are poor that I want the state to help you out. Or me, as an individual, because I have such a low income, the state ought to be helping me out. That's sort of a real personal thing that Rawls tries to step away from. So I think there is an element that's essential to justice that has to do with who we are as individuals that he's trying to remove, and that to me is somewhat disturbing. But like you say, I'm probably not reading him correctly, in part because I haven't actually read him.
That's usually a prerequisite,
right? Work on justice anyway.
Yeah. What was I going to say? Your point about defining classes away. I wouldn't say that about the theory. I mean, the theory recognizes that there's certain kinds of social realities that it wants to address. And then for what it's worth, the theory proceeds in kinds of stages, and the principles of justice are determined from behind the veil of ignorance. But then when you're talking about policy and lawmaking, the veil of ignorance is raised. And then it's a question of enacting the policies that are going to most successfully instantiate the principles of justice in our real world circumstances. And that, of course, could look very, very different. But it is sort of recognizing, I mean, one of the interesting things about the theory in some ways is that it's not a strict egalitarian theory. Rawls is going to allow for inequality in important kinds of ways. Like, the clever thing about the theory in some ways is that it's more egalitarian than strict egalitarian, because Rawls thinks that it's important that when you allow for inequality, that is going to grow the pie for everybody, in which so everybody's going to benefit. So, like, Rawls recognizes that people do in fact differ in talents, and that real and that classes exist, and like all of those things are true, but the theory is going to attempt to, so the theory like recognizes all of those social realities and then wants to generate a social order and a set of political institutions in which everybody is going to benefit. Everybody's going to do better. And the benefits and burdens of social cooperation are going to be distributed in a fair way. The theory itself, for what it's worth, is called Justice's Fairness.
Right. Also, the title of his book, his last book.
Yeah, of that of one of his books.
Right.
And so, in some ways, the underlying ethos of the theory is a kind of a fair cooperation amongst persons living together in a cooperative society.
Right.
And that idea actually is, we're clearly out of time to talk about that today.
Right.
But that, I think, is a really, really core idea to the theory that maybe I'll try to pick up on next time.
Right. So Ed, just because we are running a little bit long for a podcast, Ed, why don't you recap for us what we've done? Give us sort of the summary of all liberalism in 60 seconds or less, so that if people only hear one part of this episode, they have something they can sort of take away, saying this is what liberalism is, and I think it's right or wrong.
Yeah. Okay. Start your stopwatch. Here we go. 60 seconds. So again, I mean, liberalism is a family of political philosophies that sometimes, in fact, recommend very, very different kinds of principles of justice or outcomes, but they are all rooted in the idea that fundamentally individuals possess a certain set of natural rights and liberties that deserve respect. And again, where liberal theories differ is in the way in which they rank these rights and liberties, or the rights and liberties that they recognize, or the interpretation of these various different rights and liberties. So I would say that the disagreement between classical liberals or libertarians and progressive liberals of the kind that I aspire towards are in some ways internecine squabbles between different kinds of liberals. And I think I'm probably going over my minute, but let me just add this particular idea, is that like fundamentally just rooted in the idea that people have an intrinsic kind of dignity or value that deserves respect. And obviously various different kinds of liberals are going to explain that value differently. But then I would say, both for me individually, and then even when you look at the genesis of liberal political thought, like through the ages, the most compelling way of articulating that is that we are all of us made in the image of God. We are all of us possess an intrinsic kind of dignity or value that deserves respect. There's that lovely line from C.S. Lewis's The Weight of Glory, which is, like, to my mind, is the best thing Lewis ever wrote. I should have prepared myself so that I had the quote ready to pull. But there's that line in which he said, I mean, if you could see your neighbor as he or she really was, you would be strongly tempted to bow down and worship them. There's just this idea that human beings have just this extraordinary value and dignity. And that's the root idea to me for political liberals.
All right, very good. Well, we will end our discussion of liberalism for today and pick it up there next time, getting more into what Ed specifically believes, progressivism, libertarianism, some of the other shades of liberalism, and some of the problems with it that we did not touch on today. Mm-hmm. For the City of Man podcast, I am Coyle Neal, speaking also for Edward Song. We remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and unto God those things that are God's.
Thanks for listening.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.